This is Mae Warren. Today is the 28th of July, 1996. I'm in Lexington, Virginia with Dan Wooldridge, who has fabulous stories about fraternities. Go for it.
No fabulous stories.
Oh, yes, you
just
do.
Just a few things that happened over the years. I do recall in one particular time a fraternity brother of mine had a Model A Ford. And of course, at our fraternity, why, you parked your car around back behind the house. We had a rather large parking lot back there. And several of us decided that we wanted to play an appropriate trick on this fellow. And so a number of us got together, and we waited until we were sure that he was sound asleep. And then we went out into the backyard, and a Model A Ford was not difficult to get into at all in those days. And we took that Model A Ford and we rolled it around to the front of the fraternity house. The house had a very wide front step, probably about 12, 14 feet wide, and had double front doors. And so we managed to carry the car up the steps and open both of the front doors and get it into the front hall at the base of the stairs and close the doors, and of course we all went to sleep. And the next morning our fraternity brother came downstairs and found his Model A Ford sitting in the middle of the hall on the first floor, and having of course no idea how it got there, but even worse, I think it took him quite some time to enlist the aid of various and sundry people to figure out how to get it out of there.
Well, what was his reaction?
Well, of course, he was astounded at first, and then he was a very good sport about the whole thing. He laughed and uproariously, and thought it must have taken us several months to figure out how to pull that on him, when in fact it didn't take us very long at all.
All right, now, is he somebody who would have pulled the same kind of trick on somebody else?
Oh, easily.
Did this kind of thing go on all the time?
No, this is the only time that we had anything at our fraternity house. I'm not conversant, perhaps, with what went on in some of the others, but that was all that happened.
Now, what time period are we talking about?
This would have been about 1949, I would think. And there were a lot of veterans back in school, which was a very good thing. 47, 48, 49 in that period tempered some of the younger people and had them act a little more like adults than they might have done under other circumstances. However, on another occasion, one of those particular veterans had a little too much to drink, and we gathered him up and put him in the living room on a couch and put a blanket over him and folded his hands across his chest. And we went down in the basement and got a six-candle candelabra, very tall one, and we put that at the foot of the couch, and we got an equally tall one and put it at the head of the couch. And then we all sat around drinking beer, waiting for him to wake up. And of course, from time to time, we would make a little noise in order to make sure that he wasn't going to sleep peacefully all night long. And he finally did wake up. And when he did, and he opened his eyes, and he saw his hands were folded, and he looked down at his feet, and he saw the candelabra down there. Of course, all the other lights in the room were out. And then he looked up above his forehead, and he saw the candelabra up there. And he immediately said, if I'm alive, why am I here? And if I'm dead, why do I have to go to the bathroom? Yeah. Which send us all into uproarious laughter. One wonders, perhaps, at that remark, if maybe he were not significantly awake when we put him on the couch. Who knows? You may shut that off for a minute while I try and think of. We had a regional fraternity meeting. Our fraternity was, of course, in what was called District 2, so we had colleges and universities represented from Maryland and North Carolina and Virginia and West Virginia and Kentucky, I think. And we had a regional meeting, which is held periodically and was moved around annually to various and sundry participating fraternities in what was known in those days as Region 2 in our particular fraternity. And having these boys come from other universities, which were co-ed, this put a little bit of a burden on us because we, being at that time an all-male institution, we didn't have any way to get these fellows dates. And it was traditional that on the first night you had what was called the smoker, which was just a gathering of everybody to have a few drinks and sit around and talk and whatnot, the business of the fraternity being done in the daytime. And the second evening, or the closing evening of these festivities, was to be a sort of a dance and that sort of a thing. And we did not, as I say, have access to any girls on the campus at that time. So I was appointed the chairman of the entertainment committee to take care of this. And I went to a neighboring institution 7 miles away in Buena Vista and inquired of the lady who was in charge over there if there was any possibility at all that 60 or 70, I really didn't know how many would be required, of her girls could come over on, I believe, a Thursday night, on a weeknight, and could perhaps get dispensation to stay out a little later than normal on a weeknight and be participants in this activity. And I really didn't know how this would be, request would be received, but much to my surprise, she thought it was a very fine thing and said that she would be very happy to cooperate and she would permit her girls to stay out, as I recall, until 11:30 or midnight, which was very unusual in those days for an all-girls institution of that particular type, since they were basically an institution that was not a full college. It was 2 years of high school and 2 years of college. It was a junior college. So having gotten her approval, it then occurred to me that there had to be some way that we should select these girls. And I asked her, how could we select these girls? And she reached down and handed me the yearbook and said, take this back to Washington Lee with you and submit to me the list of the names of the girls that you would like, and I'll ask them whether they would like to come over. Well, I thought this was a marvelous thing. One of the more latter-day editions of a rogues gallery, I suppose you might say. And so I did that, and we sent her a list. We sent her a list, I think, of something like 85 girls and said that we really needed 66 or something like that because we figured that some of them would not want to come. The girls came. We had a marvelous party. We had a chaperone there who was from that seminary, and she was quite small, about 5'2" or 5'3" or so. And she came in with the girls. The girls all arrived in taxi cabs, and I had a punch bowl in one room that had nothing in it but grapefruit juice, and I had a punch bowl in the other room that had a few other things in it. And we, of course, assured the chaperone that the punch bowl with the grapefruit juice in it was the only thing that anybody was going to be drinking that evening. And the party went off very, very well. I did not take a drink the whole evening because I was concerned to make sure that everything went well. And when the party was over with, and the girls were headed back to their cabs, which had lined up in front of the fraternity house, I finally broke down and was drinking a beer when this little chaperone came running up the walk and came running up the stairs and came running up to me and sort of stomped her foot and looked up at me and says, young man, you're in charge of this. It's your fault. And I said, well, what is my fault? And she said, I've lost 7 girls. And I told her, I assured her that I was sure that she had not lost 7 girls. I told her I was sure that they would turn up certainly that evening. I didn't want her to think they would turn up the next morning. But it was true. She was short 7 girls. And I looked all over the place and couldn't find them. And it finally occurred to me that perhaps they would much rather ride back 7 or 8 miles with a Washington Lee student or some student from Pennsylvania, then to take a cab back along with five other girls. And as it turned out, that's exactly what happened. I inquired the next day, and all of the girls did get back safely, and they all did get back on time, and everything worked out very well. And it was a very happy occasion for everybody. Now you may stop.
So what do you mean the business of the fraternity was done in the day? What kind of meeting was this?
Well, this is a regional fraternity meeting, and I was not, at that particular point in the time, I was not one of the officers. You had several, as I recall, three delegates from each chapter who were attending this meeting, and it had to do with general fraternity matters, scholarship, participation in the athletics or various endeavors that were important to the university, each university, an attempt to get perhaps those fraternities who were perhaps not top drawer at their university to instill them with some of the desires and some of the recommendations that the more successful fraternities had to assist them in becoming campus leaders and that sort of thing. But if you'll turn that off for a minute, I think I have,
I want to know what brought you to Washington and Lee in the first place.
Well, it's kind of an unusual story. My father worked for the Chesapeake and Howell Railway Company, and in those days we had passenger service all over the place, which we don't have today. And I told him that, and he agreed, and so did my mother, that I wanted to go away to college. I was from Cleveland, Ohio. There were obviously a number of colleges in the state of Ohio that I could have attended. Many of my high school friends were going to Oberlin and Ohio Wesleyan and Canyon and whatnot in Ohio. And my father said, if you're going to go away to school, it would be very helpful to me financially if you would pick some place that is on the Chesapeake and Ohio Railway Company. So I looked up and I found out that in general, Washington and Lee and William and Mary and the University of Virginia, and perhaps with a little stretching, Duke, were all in that particular category. And it was probably February or January. I graduated from high school in January, and I was a mid-year graduate. And you didn't really have to have your names in with colleges until March or April. And so immediately after graduation, I took my little railroad pass and I started out on a trip. And I visited Washington and Lee and William and Mary and the University of Virginia and Duke. Spent approximately 2 days at each. And when I came back, I told my parents that there was no school that I wanted to go to other than Washington and Lee. And that's where I wanted to go, period. And fortunately, I did manage to get in.
But why Washington and Lee? What appealed to you?
Well, I was born in Richmond, Virginia. My parents were from Richmond, even though I was never raised there. And Washington and Lee, to my parents, was sort of the Harvard of the South. And they liked the idea of me going back to school in Virginia, in the state in which I was born. And that really was their reason for coming. My reason for coming was, frankly, because on the 2 days I spent at the campus, every student spoke to me, and it felt like I was home. And that suited me just fine.
We were talking about that a little bit before.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what the speaking tradition was like then.
Well, basically, you spoke to everyone on the campus. It didn't make any difference if he was, for example, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who did visit the campus. His name was Fred Vinson. His son, Fred Vinson Jr., was in school here at the time. And it didn't make any difference whether it was the local janitor or some gas station attendant or a truck driver or a fellow student, or if they were on the campus, you spoke. And you said, hi there, or good morning, or how you doing, or hey, or, you know, you might, one particular fellow who I enjoyed over the years and who later turned up to be for about 6 sessions a congressman in the United States. I'll never forget him because Jack Marsh is his name, and his favorite greeting to anybody was, how are you making it? And that's what he always said, and that's how I remember him. And I had occasion one time to impress a friend of mine was in Washington, D.C. from Chicago, and he had never been in the Capitol before, and I took him around, and we were driving up to what is the front entrance of the Capitol building on the east side. Everybody thinks the front entrance is really the west side. It's not. And we were driving up there, and the policeman stopped us and said we were not allowed to do that. And it just happened that I saw Jack walking down the steps of the Capitol, and I asked the policeman, I said, may I get out of my car for one moment? And he said, yes. And I got out. I said, may I yell at that man? And he said, yes. So I let out a whistle and said, hey, Jack, how are you making it? And he turned around and came over and shook hands, and I introduced him to my friend from Chicago. And he told the policeman, he said, this is a friend of mine. He said, let him drive around back here if he wants to do this. And of course, the officer said, yes, sir, Congressman. So it was a nice reunion. He and I had not seen each other for perhaps, at that point, maybe 20 years, that sort of thing.
So the speaking tradition does pay off?
Oh, absolutely.
That's a great story.
Absolutely. Jack was a delightful man, and still is. Later became Secretary of the Army, and after he decided he didn't want to be a politician anymore. And he's one of the real dear people that went to school here.
Now, you mentioned Fred Vinson, and that reminds me that you were here during the Bicentennial.
Right.
Tell me about what went on then.
Well, that was a... That was a huge event. Dr. Gaines was president of the Washington Lee at the time, and gained the distinction of being known as the silver-tongued orator of the South, and which he was, without question. He could speak for hours on end without a note on virtually any subject that you could think of. But the Bicentennial was very special. We felt that, starting with Liberty Hall Academy, that we had been here a long, long time, and we're going to be here for a lot longer. I think probably at that point in time, we had our attention drawn to the fact that each one of us does, in fact, owe some gratitude to George Washington at that bicentennial. I think more than the previous time, a couple of years that I was here. I think his part in donating $50,000 to the school was more emphasized than it had been previous to that. I think you find it now in most of the university publications, but I don't recall that it was pushed real hard up until the Bicentennial, but I could be wrong about that.
So what kind of events happened?
Oh, gosh. I really can't recall everything that went on. There was a number of ceremonies and that sort of thing. I think after I got out of here, I think one of the things that I was most impressed with is I came back when the front campus was declared a National Historical Landmark. And I don't remember exactly what year that was. I believe Linwood Houghton, I think, was governor of Virginia at that time. And of course, he was a graduate of Washington Land. But I don't remember just exactly when that was.
And that was a big event?
Very much so. Very much so.
Have you come back a lot as an alum?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I've come back a lot before they started the alumni college, and I've come back a lot after it was started. I've served on the alumni college board, and it's just been a very, very great experience.
Now, we were talking a little bit before about the devotion of the alumni. Can you tell me
something
about
that? I think it's a very
that?
Special thing. I hope that under the arrangement of being a co-ed institution now, I hope that that will survive. There's an awful lot of loyalty here. We had a meeting here 3 weeks ago, and a gentleman came down from Washington, D.C. to speak to us from the Smithsonian Institute, and he has spoken at a lot of colleges and universities across the country, and he made the comment to me that he had never seen or been at an institution where there seemed to be as much loyalty on the part of the alumni as there is at Washington and Lee. It's just a real warm feeling. Everybody kind of hangs together, but I think part of it in my time frame was the fact that I was here with a lot of veterans. And that tended to, it wasn't all seriousness, they all had a lot of fun, but they were interested in getting through school. They had given years to the war effort, and they were behind in their feeling, and they were here to study, and they were here to get out in the world and make their mark. And I think that that did a lot for those who were not veterans at that particular time. I think it did more for them than it actually did for the veterans when you come right down to it.
So having the veterans here enhanced your experience?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
In the classroom? Were they?
Yes.
How would that manifest itself then? Why did they make a difference?
Well, they were interested in studying. They participated in athletics. They participated in all phases of the university life. But they did not waste their time. They were not interested in wasting their time. And I think they felt that they had given up several years, some of them many years of their lives, and they were interested in getting on to the purpose of raising a family and doing their job and getting their career going, and they did not want to be interrupted in that effort.
So tell me about your academic experience here. You were thrown in a classroom and you had not only people your own age, mm-hmm. but a lot of considerably older people?
Oh yeah, oh yeah. Well, I was fortunate in that I came from a very fine high school. I went to school in Lakewood, Ohio, and it was an outstanding institution. We had even calculus and analytical geometry taught to us in high school, which was pretty rare. And when I came here to Washington Lee, I don't know how it is today, but in those days, the first 4 or 5 days, you did nothing but take tests. And then they called you in, and they permitted me to elect out of a number of freshman subjects. And so I started out in a lot of sophomore courses rather than freshmen, which made it a little bit tougher for me, and it meant that I was unable to attain some of the goals that I really thought that I should have attained, but it was a good experience for me. I really enjoyed the good lecturers, and we had some really fine, outstanding lecturers. L.K. Johnson in particular comes to mind, who was a tremendous lecturer in the business school, and of course we had some that weren't so fine, but you know, they didn't last.
What faculty members made a difference to you?
L.K. Johnson, Lewis Adams, who had been formerly a broker on Wall Street. He was almost entirely bald, and of course we naturally called him Curly Lou. And he was dean of the business of the Commerce School, and a very, very, very tough professor, unquestionably. But we had a professor in taxation accounting whose name escapes me at the moment, but I really enjoyed his courses. And I really feel that I think, as most of our graduates do, is any success that we have had in our lives has been to a great extent owed to Washington and Lee and the honor system and the way the school conducted themselves and the way we conducted ourselves.
How has the honor system made a difference then and now?
I can't speak to it now. I'm a little concerned if what I hear is correct. There seems to be now some gradation of the honor system that there seems to be a feeling that some violations of honor are not as bad as others. When I was in school here, you had you either violated the honor system or you did not. And if you violated the honor system, you had 24 hours to get out of town. And I had one particularly dear friend of mine who was expelled. He turned in a paper. It was not a term paper. It was just a monthly type paper. And he quoted directly from a book. It was not the textbook. It was a book that was in the library. And he did not put quotation marks around that quote. Nor did he, down at the bottom, put a footnote, nor did he say, as so-and-so says in their book, thus and such. The professor recognized the quote, found the book, handed the book and the paper over to the honor court. They called him up and said, is this your work? And he said, yes. And they said, this is an obvious direct quote. And he said, I should have put quotation marks around it. I neglected to do that. It was an error on my part. And they said, you have 24 hours to get out of town. Now, I don't think today that, from what I hear anyway, that the honor system is quite as stringent as that. But it was definitely stringent in my day. And I was proud of the fact that the professor would hand out his tests and then say to the students, if any of you have any question, I will be in my office. And he would leave the classroom. And you were on your honor. And so far as I know, I never cheated, and I never saw anybody that cheated. And it just became a way of life.
I need to turn the tape over.
Mm-hmm.